New York on Sunday. Big city taking a nap.
Well, after my big roll through Central Park yesterday, I'm Alex Garrett, Alex Garrett Podcasting. And on this Sunday pod, we're just going to relax. We're going to have a great conversation in just a minute with my guest who's making his first appearance today, Thomas J. Murphy. He's a financial tech consultant, and he works at Schoenfeld Strategic Advisors. And, well, Thomas, you know, you and I met on a subway in New York, and now here we are a few months later. Thanks for joining me. Schoenfeld Strategic Advisor. What I want to bring you on to talk about is numerous aspects of this pandemic and the hedge fund industry and what you're seeing with the trends. What inspired me to first hit you up, though, was when I had seen that this fallen hedge fund, Jacob Gottlieb, got this PPP loan. And when someone sees that and they see they're connected to a hedge fund, it really sort of damages the reputation of hedge funds on the whole. So I guess my question to you would be, when people see a headline like that, fallen hedge fund gets this, they shouldn't take too much stock in the hedge fund itself, right? They shouldn't still doubt the hedge fund.
It's a business like any other business, really, you know. If you're eligible for a PPP loan or any other kind of thing, it's no different than, you know, any kind of business, a retail business or a, you know so they tend not to employ a lot of people. You know, if they have financial difficulties because of COVID, then, you know, it's, you know, due to filing. Why wouldn't you?
Well, what has been going on with Schoenfeld? Because we literally met right before the pandemic. So what's been going on there during this whole time?
Well, you know, listen, it's, you know, business as usual for, you know, not just my company, but other companies in the space. And we're all working from home, and it's a little bit new for, you know, I'm on the technology side, so for me, working remotely is very, you know, second nature. I've done it a lot, but for some of our traders, it's a, you know, kind of a new experience, because normally you'd be on a trading floor with a bunch of other people and, you know, working through problems together. So it's a different way to work, but, you know, I'd say that people adopted very quickly.
I got to ask you about that, because I remember when they shut down the stock exchange floor, you almost felt it was the end of the world, didn't you?
I would say that the stock exchange, things are so much different. You know, the stock exchange floor was, you know, a thing for a long time, but a lot of the trading left the stock exchange floor in the 90s. So there hasn't, you know, it's more of like an idea than anything else. So you on the stock exchange floor today, you would have market makers who are, you know, still doing manual trading, but I'd say 99% of all trades are electronic now, and it is, you know, so it's not really done on the floor. You know, whatever happens on the floor is, it's more of, you know, they show that picture or those, you know, the video, you know, on the news clips about the stock exchange, and you see a bunch of guys yelling and screaming at each other. But, you know, for the most part, 99% of the trading is done in very quiet rooms with, you know, five or six guys, you know, sitting around the terminal.
Thomas, if that's the case, how come the markets sort of sank as that announcement was being made? Because it seemed to have really affected the market that day.
It's a, like I said, it's an idea. You know, people get panicked, but it is a... yeah, it's still the same. It's still humming. It's a bunch of machines.
Well, and Thomas, let me ask you this then, because I don't know if this is true or not, but you see the trends. When people started to get laid off, did you find them trying to invest in something to try and keep money going even after they got laid off? Did you notice any of that trend?
I have not. But I'll tell you what, though. I am not on the trading side. So, I would be more of an, like, you know, I think of me as an enabler in a sense, but not necessarily the guy that's, you know, coming up with the strategies. I help and assist, you know, make the dream a reality. So like in my world, we do, you know, millions of trades a day, and my job is to keep that humming. So I don't know. I couldn't really talk about the trade volume of a particular day unless I was looking at the, you know, the actual data.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the data then. So what data have you been seeing that maybe the regular public doesn't see or doesn't want to look into more during this whole time?
I'd say that back in March, we had some very, very heavy trade days, obviously. And then a lot of that has seems to have gone back to normal. You know, initially there was a lot of there was a lot of heavy trading. But, if you're looking at the market, it's up 100, down 100, up 200, down 300. You know, it's volatile within and, but it's not swinging up and down thousands of points at this, today. So
maybe you can answer this. I know you do the data. So let's say a vaccine gets announced. I feel like when those announcements of the actual vaccine or that there were successful trials, that does affect the market, doesn't it? I'm sure you're seeing that.
Oh, of course, but it would affect, obviously that would have some market effect and people would have to, the market would rally behind something like that because that would mean that people would be going back into the offices and going back to work increasing, I guess, in person, I guess it would affect the retail sector. It would affect, restaurants and anybody that's associated with restaurants because more people would go out. It would affect, you'd have to, it would affect maybe medical supplies also because you see companies that are making, are trying to catch up with PPE, the demand for face masks and things like that. So if they came out with a cure tomorrow, maybe those companies would be doing less volume. So you'd have to kind of consider how how that would affect that company. There's so many things that you would have to kind of consider. I think when you're talking about like a hedge fund or you're talking about or an investment bank, there's different trading strategies that different portfolio managers have, and some of them are quantitative and would take that into account. But I don't think that, they're basically going off of, different strategies, different algorithms, say, for instance. So if I'm like a market maker, say, for instance, none of that stuff would matter.
And on the IT side, I know you said you're an enabler. So what have you been able to do? How have you been able to get your company, people that invest with Schoenfeld, how have you been able to help them survive this pandemic?
My job is we have data centers all over the world or co-locations all over the world where we keep our servers next to markets. And we keep our portfolio managers, we keep any kind of technology problems transparent to our portfolio managers. We have backups and we have all kinds of stuff that, my job is to make sure that those guys sit at their desks and are able to pull the trigger on any trade that they want to, that they want to do. So for us, the infrastructure is always there and it's just vigilant monitoring, making it better, faster, stronger, more resilient to, physical things like if somebody kicks a hard drive out or if, we lose some storage. We want to make that completely transparent to the guys who are on our front office and in our front desk. And that's the job of anybody in operations really is to sort of make, the infrastructure for which is required by the company as transparent as possible, like it's not even a thought. It's always there. It's always like, they don't have to worry about it. It's like picking up a phone, you would expect to hear a dial. And that's, if that's my job, that's what it is. These guys pick up, and they're able to trade flawlessly every single time. And, for the most part, we deliver that. Occasionally we'll have some glitches, but,
as an IT person, when you see places like Twitter get hacked or you see other institutions get hacked, that must drive you crazy because you guys are working hard. But does that threat exist within your field as well? I'm sure it does, right?
We have a lot less. Of course, anybody can get hacked, right? And obviously, if you're a large hedge fund or investment bank, there's a target on you, right? But I think the advantage that we would have over like a Twitter or a Facebook or any of these other companies is that a lot less of our infrastructure is publicly exposed. I think you'd have like a website, those websites are are usually non-transactional. Like if you went to Renaissance Technologies website or Millennium Partners Technology, or Millennium Partners, MLP.com or something like, one of those websites for a hedge fund that's similar to ours, you would notice that, there's not a lot of interaction that that one can do. So most times, like with Twitter or Facebook get hacked or, it's usually through like a web interface or a phishing attack or, it's like a web-based type of attack. But for us, in my line of work, we don't have a lot of front end exposure to a lot of people. So if you were targeting like a hedge fund or something like that, you'd have to kind of find one or two exposed systems out on the internet, and then you'd have to look for security holes within that, or you could do a phishing attempts, and those are actually kind of effective, but.
Well, how do you guys manage global aspect of this? Because I know you just said you're globally. So how do you get all those systems managed for your hedge fund runners and advisors and traders? Like, how do you make sure all of that's maintained? It seems complex from where I'm sitting.
If you have a couple of thousand machines in any kind of company, there's definitely some techniques you could do. First off, we have a security team that is everybody in my line, there's always a security team. And if anything needs to get, like a couple of days ago, Red Hat came out with a security flaw and there's a fix for that already. So we are going to push that out this week and make sure that we are covered in that aspect. So it's always, we know, we deal with our vendors a lot when there's a patch or a security fix or something like that, we push it out immediately. For other things, we have configuration, like configuration management tools like Ansible or Chef. And, what we do with those is if we change something, one setting on one system, we test it, we make sure that it works really well, or, it provides the, like a kernel parameter or something like that on some of our Unix systems. And, we find that, that has some really good effect on this subset of servers. So with our configuration management, we'll pull a trigger and, it'll go out and it'll configure all those servers the same exact way, within that group or that inventory. And then if anybody, and if we run that on a daily basis, if anybody makes, changes something on that system, when we run our configuration management tool, it'll revert back to the way that we had set it up initially. So it makes it harder to deviate from like a particular subset of, or type of system that we have configured for certain things. So our trading systems, the ones that are actually trading are configured one way. Our customer facing, servers are, configured another way with, extra security and stuff like that. Our development servers, where our development tools are, we have a bunch of people logging into and writing code for us, all have the same kind of tools and things installed on there, configured another way. So, and we keep it as uniform as possible. And, with the configuration management, it forces that uniformity.
Thomas, for those who know you, may not know your story. So tell me here, what got you into this whole finance tech field that you have grown into here?
My gosh, I kind of fell into it. I didn't, do school or university the traditional way. I sort of, I was going part-time, and I think I wanted to do computer science, and I ended up in a job where I was going to different data centers and, for like Dell, I didn't work for Dell, but I worked for a company that was, had contracts with Dell and HP, and I would run out and I would change out a hard drive or add memory to a system, or, you know, and that was my job for a couple of years. And because I knew Unix, an internet service provider asked me to go work for them. And I said, yeah, that's, you know, so I, you know, became a systems administrator. And then because I was in school also for computer science, I was doing systems administration and software development in school. I worked for the American Institute of Physics as a Unix and C programmer. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I found my way into AIG as a project manager, you know, and managed a lot of their, you know, larger corporate, you know, treasury type projects and things, you know, things like that. And, you know, over my career, I kind of flip-flop back and forth between managing, you know, large numbers of systems as a systems administrator or engineer, or writing software for companies. And I've kind of, from AIG, I went to Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, Bank of America twice. I was working for them. I went to Millennium Partners. I was there for a bunch of years. You know, BNP Paribas, I was working on the trading floor as a, you know, as an engineer there. So, you know, I have a specialty niche for, you know, software. Yeah, I'm a systems engineer that writes a lot of software development, you know, like writes a lot of software. So I kind of fill this like niche between, you know, like a traditional systems administrator and a traditional software engineer. And there's like a need for someone in that space. Like, for instance, like 2 days ago, we were finding that like in a file transfer, you know, we were having, you know, we were able to duplicate it with a piece of C code that a file transfer was failing between two servers and, you know, in different data centers. And why is this happening? And, you know, I was able to write some code and, you know, trace system calls and, you know, do a bunch of stuff that, you know, normally would fall in between, you know, like in between these two particular jobs, but I was lucky enough where I've had that kind of experience for both. So that's how I ended up doing what I do. You know, banks and hedge funds are prevalent in New York. So, you know, it was only a matter of time before I ended up working in, you know, in this, you know, this industry. They're the ones that hire the most technologists here. If I was in Silicon Valley, I'd probably work with Twitter or something.
Tom, it's very interesting to say about how, and that is fascinating, but I want to say thank you then, because it seems like because of your efforts and so many tech efforts, businesses were literally able to get the, you know, stock screens in their own office. I think I told you this story. I was at MDSAS years ago, and they had the trading floor. They had all the stocks and everything on their screens. And I, as we're talking here, I'm like, well, that's because of your guys' efforts, because you guys put it in the offices. And so that was about 20 years ago. So when that shift started to happen, I guess that was sort of a telltale sign that, yeah, trading was changing right before our very eyes.
It became easier, you know, it's, you know, and also the humans, you know, on those exchange floors were not able to keep up with the quantitative strategies. So if I have a computer system, like I would literally shave nanoseconds off of a trading, you know, situation, like our trading, you know, by taking a 5 millimeter network cable and making it a 3 millimeter network cable. And that would save me 2 nanoseconds, and that would help me beat, you know, get to a deal. There's no way a human can operate in nanoseconds. That's a billionth of a second of nanoseconds. So, you know, if I'm able to, so within one, you know, within 1 second, 1 second is an eternity to people in, you know, high frequency trading, where, yeah, within that 1 second, I'm doing, you know, I can do a million trades in that 1 second off that one system. That's just, yeah. You know, making those trades all day. And you know, that sort of volume and frequency would be on the trading floor to do it.
That is, I know, we see the fast paces. It's kind of like a glorified fast-paced thing we see on TV or even in trading places, other movies like that. But I've got to say, what was that transition like moving the stock floor to business offices? Like, was that was that exciting to you to help move all of this into the business office world?
I think when I started on Wall Street, you know, again, this was back in the, you know, late 80s. And, you know, I wasn't working for an investment bank, but I was working on Wall Street at this technology firm there. And you would see people coming out of the buildings drunk at 8 o'clock in the morning from the night desk someplace, or, you know, they were working, you know, they were trading nights and they were loaded. Or, you know, it was, you know, the '80s had, you know, Wall Street was famous for the cocaine and the drinking and the partying. And, you know, it was almost like, you know, you know, Chad would go into it, you know, we'd go into work one day and say, you know, guys, I was at the Chevy dealership. I was buying a Chevy over the weekend. The place was packed. Buy a million shares of Chevy. You know, like, and it went from that, where, you know, to, you know, a lot of math, you know, frankly, a lot of math geniuses and kind of nerds taking over Wall Street because they were, you know, doing things quantitatively. If you look at, like, some of the biggest hedge funds, you know, Jim Simmons runs Renaissance Technologies, and Stephen Schoenfeld is, you know, known to be, you know, into stats. You know, he runs Schoenfeld, and, you know, most of these guys who are portfolio managers have degree, you know, graduate degrees in finance, physics, mathematics, statistics, applied mathematics. You know, those are, those are the degrees that these portfolio managers have. And, you know, it went from this, like, really, you know, party type of environment to, you know, almost overnight in the 90s and early 2000s to this collegiate, you know, sort of academic type of environment, which, you know, surprised a lot of people. And,
you know, I want to cover 08 too, because I'm sure you have a lot of stories during that meltdown of, you know, the tech side especially. But really quickly, you just mentioned some hedge fund managers. And Stephen Cohen's been in the news because he wants to buy the Mets. So when someone like that, when a hedge fund manager is in the news, or one of your guys is in the news, do you find the traffic to all of these sites just jump up when these guys are mentioned? Or what drives the traffic to websites for Schoenfeld or even other hedge fund managers, you know, sites?
I think, you know, nothing. If I were to guess, I'm not looking at the web stats, but, like, in Schoenfeld, I don't, like, we market, but our marketing is very different than, you know, like, our marketing department obviously do things very differently than somebody's marketing toward consumers. So, you know, if we're marketing, we're marketing at somebody that is, you know, running a pension plan or an endowment fund, or we, you know, like those, you know, so it's a, you know, it's a very different type of thing than being, you know, wanting to be incredibly public and having consumers come to us, because consumers are not the buyers of our product. You know, like, for you to invest in a hedge fund, you know, you have to meet certain criteria, which automatically makes you like a millionaire, because, you know, these strategies are not like, I personally don't invest in a hedge fund, because, like, it's a very, you know, high, you know, bar to, you know, to get over. For a lot of hedge funds. So, you know, I'm like anybody else. I have, like, my 401k, and I have these long-term sort of, you know, investments in, you know, my personal life. But, you know, for you to invest in a hedge fund, you have to meet a certain criteria in terms of your financial income or your holdings. And the reason for that is the SEC says, you know, these are kind of, you know, risky investments. You know, these guys are not, you know, sometimes they, you know, doing fundamental trading. They're doing, you know, some of them are doing, you know, quantitative trading where, you know, they're shorting, you know, stocks, and they're doing, well, you know, options. They're, you know, they can invest in, you know, the more exotic products if they wanted to. They can do whatever they want. So, so we're not, you know, so our web traffic and maybe consumer awareness is not, what you would consider to be, like, you know, driving traffic to our site. Obviously, if somebody in the, you know, made the news, you know, for partying, you know, out in the Hamptons or something like that, then, you know, it would drive some interest. But when you came to our sites or our website, you know, our websites are very, you know, generic and, you know, for public consumption, like, you know, hey, we're a trading advisor, but, you know, that's really about the, you know, you wouldn't see, like, and we put maybe if we had some news stories in the, you know, recently in the news, and again, our news stories would be like on the business section where, you know, we acquired, you know, a portfolio manager, or we, you know, somebody joined our firm, you know, if it made the news, it would, you know, but it's not the type of thing that, like, you know,
and actually I would say because of sort of the, I had to say, anti-capitalist feeling I get in the news today. It more likely all these stories get reported are bad news. And I always think that doesn't help the cause either, you know? Like, come on, there's got to be some good coming out of capitalism to this day, and we got to talk about that.
Well, you know, there's a lot of good things that come out of capitalism. I mean, innovation comes from capitalism. Now, if you have venture capitalists, they're investing in startup companies and startup technologies and startup ideas and, you know, the ways, ways to do things differently, which is kind of what we all want, right?
Absolutely. And this
but,
is why.
But to do that, you're going to need I couldn't just say, you know what? I think I want to do this thing. I want to start my own gig because I need, research and resources and, and I have to get funded by somebody. It's always, investments I could do that. Or maybe two companies are well positioned to be partners and somebody has to handle the banking and the merger and acquisition. And,
And I think there is what we have to say, and maybe you can say it too, is that it's amazing when someone, our next door neighbor, so to speak, can invest in a project we're doing. Like, that is what self-reliance is about. That's what America is about. When people around you invest in your project, I think that's the most beautiful thing, actually.
It is great. we know that, we look at other places where, the state funds everything and it doesn't work out as good. I mean, the innovation in technology is coming from the United States. It's coming from, Europe. Our problem is we have to protect our IP because it's getting stolen. By countries who are not doing the same type of work we are.
And, whatever you think of President Trump, he has tried to stop the intellectual stealing, and I don't know if you've had that try from Chinese companies, but they exist. I mean, they're trying to steal our property to this day, and yet just yesterday, TikTok was sold, the Chinese aspect of it was sold off, and I thought, another win. You get China out of our hair again, and I think that gets a lot. That should get more praise than it's getting right now, whenever those things can happen, when we can get...
I'm on TikTok. I can tell you, everybody on TikTok is delighted that their platform isn't going away. All these people with like a billion followers are like, oh my God, I've worked so hard to get a billion followers. You can't just pull the rug out from under me.
I don't have millions, but I have enough. And it helped me through the quarantine, to be very honest with you, and I just keep going with it.
I'm actually a recent user. I don't have any videos posted, but I love the content creators on this platform because there's a lot of really interesting and just brilliant content out there. There's a lot of junk also, but I can appreciate the people giving an effort and trying new things, and that's a lot of fun, man. I'm addicted to scrolling through TikTok videos.
Alex Jean NYC, because I'm still there. I'm there. Shameless self-promotion.
I love it.
Hey, no, but now that we're on this, though, on the China part, I want to specifically hone in on, have you seen companies sort of funded by China try and infiltrate your systems?
I don't know. I don't know about infiltrate. I mean, we are in, we're in a global, business. So we have partners all over Asia. we were in the news famously for acquiring Folger Hill for their Asian, trading group. And I don't think I'm divulging any secrets here, but, we have, traders sitting in Hong Kong, they're our partners. They're part of our company.
So how can Americans distinct from, all right, well, this company is a Chinese company. When I hear that, I say, well, it's maybe a Chinese-owned company versus, no, it's an independent company that just happens to be from China or another part of Asia.
Right. I think with the TikTok deal, there's some kind of requirement that they must share data with the government in China. I don't know how that works, but. And my feeling was that, I don't really understand why it got so big in the U.S. because, or to use it. I don't think why do users at this point care? Because TikTok is stealing the same information that the U.S. government is already taking, or or Facebook is already taking. Like, it's the same data. It's on your cell phone. You're using technology on your cell phone, and you're already giving it away. So like, why are we so upset that yet another entity is getting my what I'm watching on Netflix on my cell phone, or what am I what I'm listening to on Amazon Prime Music or something? Like, I don't know. It's like, what sort of secret data? I don't know why this particular thing bothered people so much, because if you're on a cell phone right now today, everybody's getting your data.
I'm so glad you said that, because the data mining has existed long before TikTok ever did. Let's put it that way.
Oh, sure. And Facebook famously is always, under fire for the way they treat your personal data. And there's even documentaries about it on the internet. And it's, what's the big deal at this point? You have 50 apps on your phone. If you don't want your data being tracked, just take your cell phone, or go to a flip phone.
The Cambridge Analytica, we almost forget about that now, right? But that was a thing.
Right. Yeah, that was all Facebook data, wasn't it?
And yet that seems to be forgotten this weekend alone. Hey, Thomas, let's go to 2008, though, because I'm very curious how the technology sector and the IT of the finance world, if that was the takeoff point for you guys, like if that was the moment where people said, okay, we got to really buckle down here. So if a recession happens, at least we have the technology to withstand it. Would you say that was a push off point to really increase the IT awareness?
No. We were, very much. I would say that there was a bunch of things prior to that that was kind of interesting. One was the influx of quantitative trading, and that was really the driver of away from the trading floor into more of a technology driven sort of company. So if you look at like some banks like Two Sigma, for instance, is a famous hedge fund. If you look at their website, they build themselves as a technology company. If you go to Goldman Sachs' website, they almost build themselves as a technology company versus they used to build themselves as an investment bank, but now these companies are starting to kind of see themselves as sort of technology hybrid type companies, or because they need to attract, I guess, technologists. But but that all came about because of the quantitative trading and the there was, almost like a, like an arms race in a sense to get bigger, better, faster systems. And, there's a company called GTS. They are one of the, there's like one of two designated market makers on the New York Stock Exchange. And there's a famous story about them. They have a company called Strike Technologies, and they wanted to get data faster from the CME exchange in Chicago to New York. And a company went and they drilled a hole through mountains to, to get this cable, the most direct, straight, fiber optic cable they could from Chicago to New York. And they were able to beat other people to this information within, a couple of nanoseconds or a couple of microseconds or whatever. And so that, they were selling this. And it was incredibly valuable to have the data a couple of microseconds before everybody else. And the GPS technologies, basically made that cable, that they spent, they spent, probably $1 billion to create this cable. But GPS technologies within a year or two made that thing completely obsolete, because then they found that they can, use microwaves. So GPS now has a microwave, network to get Chicago, CME data to New York faster than that cable did. And the idea was to get that information just a few microseconds faster. So when you have a race like that, if I have that information a few microseconds faster, I can make that trade faster, and I'm the one that gets that business, and that other guy does not get that business. So that's the thing that built up Wall Street technology, that sort of speed and that sort of those sorts of algorithms to make things happen at a faster rate. And that's why, you know, and it's like a Cold War, because if a new product comes out, you know, we're all buying that new product to make, you know, because that product promises I could do something a nanosecond faster or a microsecond faster. So we all have to, you know, we have Wall Street has budgets for technology, and we all have to go out and get that stuff, and we all have to make sure that we're on, we remain on a level playing field, you know, with our competitors. And the thing that should, you know, so that's the thing that drives technology on Wall Street. So by 2007, 2008, we were already, you know, well underway into that, you know, we were already, you know, there and, you know, trading. And now we've just, you know, made things faster, you know, to keep up with our competitors.
This is fascinating because I still see us in these races for technology. I still see us trying to get to 5G or get to like the 6G over everybody else. I still see us trying to beat out China, Russia, and even Iran on the technological front. I would say I'm not sure if we're ahead of them yet. I would love to be ahead of them. Maybe you could weigh in on that. But I do know, speaking of cable and everything and towers, people were knocking down the 5G towers because they thought that was the reason why Corona was happening. I thought that was kind of insane. But, you know, for a long time, we've been trying to get
there. I don't know how that works.
We were together, though, against China, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think everybody wants to get, you know, like, the faster, better technology, you know, because, it's great for, you know, nationalistic, you know, national pride, you know, like, hey, we invented this thing, you know, everybody's using it, it's, you know, like, but, you know, from more of a corporate space, you know, like anything else, if you have a better technology, people are going to use it, and you're going to make more sales, so, it's what happened to Nokia, I guess. They stayed with they had this brick model that everybody is familiar with, but they, you know, were not able to get into the smartphone business like when Apple came out with their stuff, and companies that were able to adapt, move forward. So like, you know, so who is it? Samsung and Apple now, I guess, or
right.
Google, Samsung, and Apple. Yeah, like if you're able to keep up with, you know, able to run apps and able to do things on your smartphone. So like, that's what happened to a lot of companies. Like they're not able to adapt to newer technology, and nobody wants to use old slow stuff. I remember when I used to see 3G on my cell phone, I'd be like, yes, I have internet. You know, now I see 3G on my cell phone and I cringe. I'm like, oh no, it should be 4G LTE or something.
You know. LTE baby all the way. I love LTE. Hey, Thomas though, I gotta ask you this as we're talking. I'm excited about how this could be just conversation one of so many, because I'm sure even as we get back into reopening and everything more so, you'll have more insight into what's going on. But what did you guys learn in the IT space from the 2007-2008 collapse to do it maybe even better during this pandemic and keep things running while everything else seemingly fell apart?
I wouldn't say those are the key moments for us. I'd say in my line of work, you know, in investment banking, I think we were already, you know, structured in terms of technology so that people can work from home. I think other companies are, you know, so we had things employed like Citrix and, Zoom meetings and, you know, like everybody, you know, everybody had that on our desktop. We've had that on our desktops for a long time. And, we've gone through, because in the banking industry, you know, you have to go through disaster recovery drills and you have to work, you know, be able to work remotely. So, you know, those things became, you know, for us, those things have been around for a long time, like virtual desktops. And, you know, like I can sit at a desk in my company and pull up my desktop. That's my desktop in some place, sitting on a virtualized server somewhere. And when I log in from my house, I get that very same desktop on my at home. So, you know, so we've had, you know, for us, it's, you know, we've had these for a long time. I would say that in terms of banking, I would say that the bigger conversation is always, these flash crashes that happen, because like, those are interesting to me, or, you know, as a technologist, because here we have these self-employed, you know, we've written these algorithms, you know, like we'll do, like let's say pairs trading, like a quantitative, you know, algorithm at a very high level. I'm not giving any trade secrets away or anything like that. But like, you know, if I notice that Home Depot is selling at, you know, X, you know, that there's, you know, 80% of the time, if Home Depot goes up, Lowe's will go up because they're in the same, you know, same business, you know, type of business. So like a quantitative researcher might look at the historical, you know, correlation between these two stocks and write some sort of algorithm, right? And if he wins 75% of the time, then, you know, that's a great, you know, micro strategy, or, you know, it's a great strategy to have.
Absolutely.
So, you know, like, yeah, that's great. So when a flash crash happens, you know, you see the market drop, and then it seems to like spiral thousands of points because all these algorithms are kicking off. Like, you know, like if one bad thing happens, it's almost like a chain reaction for all these algorithms to sell or to, you know, to do something. So like, you'll see these like crazy, it'll drop like 2,000 or 3,000 points and then like zip right back up again, because somebody's short sale algorithms have kicked in. And everybody starts shorting stocks, and like, you know, as a reaction to that, you know, somebody's, you know, options start kicking in, and you know, like algorithms start kicking in and goes right back up again. So those things are kind of wonky, and I don't, I don't know what the answer is, how to fix that, but you know, there is danger to trading at these kinds of speeds. Famously, there was a company, Knight Capital Group, they had lost $400 million in 45 seconds because, you know, one of their systems, you know, they might have had like 8 systems that had a software patch on it. And, you know, one, you know, a guy, you know, didn't put it on that like 8th system or didn't install correctly on that 8th system. So now they had 7 trading one algorithm and 1 trading another algorithm. And as a result of that, they lost, you know, $400 million in 45 seconds, and it nearly put the company out of business. They had to take in outside money or capital from another company out in Chicago. But you know, those sorts of things are terrifying and frightening to us. And, you know, we're always trying to find a way not to do that.
Tom, I got to ask you, so to wrap this conversation up for now, I want to definitely continue this down the road, but do you think we put too much stock in the stock market to the point where, yeah, those flash crashes are devastating because we rely on it? And we being sort of the economy, but I would say the everyday person doesn't always check the stock market, right? So how would you advise someone who may not want to follow it but should be following it? What's your advice to the Americans that may not follow the markets as closely?
You know, listen, I have a lot of friends. I cannot manage my own portfolio. Actually, I'm not allowed to manage my own portfolio. I have to have somebody else do it for me. But I would recommend, you know, if you have some kind of control over your portfolio, or if you don't, you know, either deal with a manager, like a financial advisor, that is a fiduciary advisor that's going to be on your side, not necessarily, you know, just selling you single products from a, you know, from their company. So, always check that, you know. You know, ask if they're a fiduciary advisor or not. And then, you know, if not, if you don't want to spend those kinds of fees, you know, which is like 1% or something like that, or 1.5%, you know, think of that. You know, pick up an S&P 500, index type fund. You know, those are, you know, if you're not going to watch it, do that. And then, you know, for your 401ks, this is for people that don't watch this stuff. What I advise, and I'm a technologist, but I'm in the same boat as you are or anybody else is, where I'm not managing my own portfolio. I pick that, you know, that fund that, you know, like a year, you know, the year I retire, like everybody has that, like, you know, take a 2035 fund or the, you know, whatever fund, you know, that is. And, you know, if I wanted to be more aggressive, I'd, you know, push it out 10 years. But if not, you know, because that kind of balances your portfolio for you. I know a lot of people that, you know, that have, you know, stuff in their 401k and they bought stock and they bought these indexes and stuff like that, but then they don't use it. They never look at it again. And that stuff makes me cringe because, and again, this is not me speaking as a professional trader, because I'm not, but you know, nobody's responsible for your retirement other than you. You're responsible for that, unless you have like some kind of pension fund or something. But like, you're the guy that's responsible for, you know, not eating cat food, you know, when you retire. So, you know, it's, I wouldn't, you know, if you're not going to watch it, put in, you know, get some of these, you know, get a manager to watch it, or get, you know, get a, you know, a fund that is going to historically, you know, rebalance itself like the S&P 500, and, you know, do things to kind of ensure your retirement. You know, Thomas, this stuff makes me nervous.
I am a little nervous to get into the stocks myself, but for people that do want to sort of, and if they can do a hedge fund, but anyway, for those who might be interested more, can they contact you? And are you, is your company always looking to keep advising people in the markets?
Well, we would not advise, like, you know, most, like, you would have to be like, you know, you would have to invest as a partner into our fund, which is, you know, not for most Americans. You know, I can, it's for some, but you know, like, we're, you know, it's not the same thing as, like, let's say going to TD Ameritrade and opening up a brokerage account there. Like, you know, we're a different thing. Because
totally.
By law, we're only allowed to have X number of, you know, whatever that number is, you know, investors. We're not allowed to have mass investors. So, you know, we have a criteria, I think, for investing. Even if we're, and a lot of hedge funds are not looking for investors. A lot of them are closed up. We might even be closed. I don't know. But I would say that, you know, a place like TD Ameritrade or Fidelity, or, you know, I'm a huge fan of Charles Schwab. I love Charles Schwab. You'll always get a person on the phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you open a brokerage account with them, it comes with the best checking account ever, with zero fees and, no ATM fees ever, anywhere in the world.
I wrote a whole premise on Medium.com about how the Ameritrade Schwab merger probably was such a great sign that business was back. I mean, when these mergers happen, I think now it's a good sign that the economy, well, in 2019, that the economy was humming, that they were able to make this merger, and it seemed to have bettered the customer, didn't it?
I don't know, man. I don't know how it makes the customer better. I think both had solid products, but, you know, as a customer of Charles Schwab, personally, I want to say this, I get no money from those people at all, but I think they're fantastic. I really like them as a, you know, from a consumer perspective, you know, I rarely experienced better customer service than with them. And their products, I think, you know, when I used to work for Bank of America, and I used to get like fees all the time.
I got you, Thomas. Yeah, say that one more time.
Alex?
Yeah, I'm here. Oh,
okay.
I'm here.
So the first I used to use, like, you know, Bank of America for my checking account. I used to get fees all the time. And, you know, I moved over to Charles Schwab, and I haven't seen a single fee any place ever. You know, even for ATM withdrawals and things like that, it gets put back in my account at the end of the month. And, you know, as somebody who's, like, if you travel a bit and you're overseas and you use the ATM, you're getting it at the day's best rate, you know, the currency exchanges. And, like, you know, it's little things like that that are like, man, this is fantastic. I love it.
Thomas, one last thing. One thing that many people may not know about you and I know this is your first podcast, so one thing people may not know about you that you're comfortable sharing anyway, before we wrap up today.
Let's see. Love dogs. Have two kids that are like 4 and 5 years old, or 5 and 6 years old now. They got, yeah. You know, and my life is a complete zoo. I have a wife, and you know, we live out on Long Island. Otherwise, I'm pretty straightforward and, you know, pretty standard.
Well, Thomas, I don't know if we'll ever see each other.
Nothing but chaos.
I don't know if we'll ever see each other again on a subway, but we might. So hopefully that day will come again, right?
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
And,
we'll see. Well, I'm not really looking forward to commuting again. I got to tell you the truth. I'd rather stay home.
I hear that. And I know you're out on Long Island, I think. So that's a different breed than the city right now, because it seems a little more open out there, actually.
Yeah, it's like I said, I feel like I've been pretty fortunate to be out here for this because, we all have a backyard, as we said, in the backyard where these guys I work with that, are in 2 or 3 bedroom apartments and like they do not have, they have no backyard to go to. And it's, I couldn't even imagine. So,
Thomas, lucked out. Yeah, and definitely blessed for sure by him. And it's Sunday, so I figured I'd throw that in there. So, Thomas, God bless you, man, and keep up the great work keeping our financial sector as steady as possible through the tech field. And please come back, and I'd love to have you back.
Oh, man. Great. Thanks very much. Cheers. Good luck, man. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. I'm Alex Garrett. We will talk to you again in the upcoming week. Stay safe.